was just 0.6%. From 2018 through 2021, the growth rate was even worse, just 0.5%, putting the Eurozone on track for a second consecutive lost decade.
Despite the clear failure of austerity policies in producing growth, President Emmanuel Macron will continue with far-right economics in his second term. His finance minister boasted of plans to cut much-needed public spending to a 20-year low, citing a desire to submit to Brussels' entirely arbitrary 3% rule on public deficits.
We're talking about a systemic crisis in Europe, and one which existed before the crisis caused by the pandemic, as well as the crisis caused by the need to find alternative energy sources other than Russia. What it all adds up to is that a state of crisis continuing still.
This week, the new and deeply fractured National Assembly passed the Emergency Purchasing Power Bill, aimed at countering still rising once-in-a-generation inflation. At just 20 billion euros, it has been widely criticized as an ineffective and even superficial measure.
For many people, this bill is insufficient in comparison with the scope of the crisis. The same criticism has been made of a government fuel rebate of 18 cents, which began in April. However, it is 20 billion euros which will help the poorest level of society and students deal with the effects of high inflation.
France's government claims that upcoming austerity rollbacks planned for the pension and unemployment system will actually produce broad economic growth this time. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates, even though the Eurozone is already on the brink of recession. Sanctions and not diplomacy continues to be the destabilizing Western choice regarding Ukraine. The long-term economic outlook for France and the Eurozone appears bleak to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of Palestinians took part in funeral processions of Mohammed Azizi, 25, and Abdurrahman Subh, 28, who were killed early Sunday during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and its old town. The Fatah Armed Wing Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade says the two Palestinians were its members, while the Israeli military says the operation in Nablus was launched to apprehend armed suspects. Following the raid, a general strike called across Nablus to mourn the death of the two Palestinians.
The operation this time was more violent than the previous ones. Clashes were heavy as Israeli soldiers raided the neighborhood from all sides. Live ammunition and rockets were fired towards the houses. I believe such ammunition are only used in wars between countries.
Israeli forces raided Al-Yasamin neighborhood and surrounded a house, which the regime said Palestinian fighters had barricaded themselves in. Eyewitnesses described the raid as a full-blown military invasion, while the Palestinian Red Crescent reported 19 injuries, including 10 people, hit by live fire. The Palestinian leadership has condemned the operation, with a spokesman of the Palestinian president saying the Israeli crime will not defeat the Palestinians and will not break their will.
It's a barbaric act. It's another crime committed by the Israeli forces. They fired rockets at a house and they knew people were inside it. Two young men were killed and many others were wounded. It's obvious that the entire region will remain in a circle of violence until the occupation ends.
At least 52 Palestinians have been killed since late March, as Israel has intensified its aggression after a wave of deadly anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military has never stopped its raids in the occupied West Bank. Such operations have often led to the death and injury of Palestinians, like what happened in Nablus. Regardless of how many people are killed or injured in the raids, Palestinians say resistance is their only option until they free the occupied territories. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Okay. We all remember her from pictures. At the time that her father was assassinated, Armita Razainejad was only 5. Her mother, Shohra Pirani, was also wounded in the attack. Today, her story has found its way on the silver screen, revealing new dimensions of how Dariush Razainejad was martyred. What made the ordeal even tougher was the fact that Dariush was shot right in front of his wife and his 5-year-old daughter. The international community, human rights advocates, and even the UN remained silent. This prompted Shohra Pirani to write a letter to then-U.S. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, denouncing in the strongest terms the assassination of researchers and scientists. Her move inspired a group of filmmakers to make a movie based on the story.
About 5 or 6 years ago, we decided to make this movie. I believe that as filmmakers, we had a responsibility to do so.
This is a very important part of our contemporary history. It's a story that just had to be told. It should have been done sooner.
I was preoccupied by this incident for years. How can you kill someone right in front of his 5-year-old kid? I did some research, and as soon as the opportunity came up, we decided to make the movie.
Hanas, which literally means breath, is a biopic that dramatizes the story of Dariush Razainejad, a nuclear scientist that was assassinated in 2011.
This movie is actually a document that shows how Iran has been a victim of terror attacks. There aren't many countries in which such brutal terror attacks have happened. The assassination of a scientist and researcher while his family is watching.
This was a very educational movie showing us the animosity of Israel and the United States.
I found it to be an educational movie, both important and interesting.
I learned a lot. It was very interesting.
The feminine touch has turned this biopic into a must-see, and now, in an open letter, Armita has called on all foreign ambassadors in Iran to watch the movie, too.
In the words of Armita, the daughter of the martyred scientist Dariush Razainejad, Iranian or non-Iranian, everyone should watch this movie just to catch a glimpse of the atrocities and human rights violations that are committed against the Iranian people, while the international community remains silent. Kisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together 80 million people for peace. Let's get together people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because everyone wants to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. New South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a hard line with North Korea, boosting the country's military and strengthening its alliance with the United States, with joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises planned for next month. Advocates for peace, like those gathered here today, have an uphill battle. Frank Smith, South Korea.
A gathering of Lebanese journalists and activists was held in the South Lebanon town of Naqoura to protest against Israel's extraction activities in the disputed waters.
We are so powerful, we can fight, we can go to war in case the enemy wants a war, unless we get our rights and our wealth in the sea and
on the land.
Former head of the Lebanese negotiating team told Press TV that any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the other party.
One of the strongest points is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation or for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form diplomatic or political or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July.
We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed, and nine both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Veretz, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old, and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotavets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Diana Spitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. They basically That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. So, like the old saying is that the other's one's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The Limelight.
In the U.S., Mark Short, who was Chief of Staff of Vice President Mike Pence, and Greg Jacob, a lawyer for Mike Pence, have been subpoenaed in the Justice Department's expanding criminal inquiry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Top Pence aides testified to grand jury in January 6 investigation. Two top aides to former Vice President Mike Pence testified last week to a federal grand jury in Washington investigating the events surrounding the January 6 attack on the Capitol, the highest-ranking officials of the Trump administration so far known to have cooperated with the Justice Department's widening inquiry into the events leading up to the assault on the Capitol. The appearances before the grand jury of the men, Mark Short, who was Mike Pence's chief of staff, and Greg Jacob, who was his counsel, were the latest indication that the Justice Department's criminal investigation into the events surrounding and preceding the riot is intensifying after weeks of growing questions about the urgency the department has put on examining former President Donald J. Trump's potential criminal liability. The testimony of the two Pence aides marked the first time it has become publicly known that figures with first-hand knowledge of what took place inside the White House in the tumultuous days before the attack have cooperated with federal prosecutors. Both Mark Short and Greg Jacob played important roles in describing to a House Select Committee conducting a parallel investigation of the Capitol attack how Donald Trump, working with allies like the lawyer John Eastman, mounted a campaign to pressure Mike Pence into disrupting the normal counting of Electoral College votes on 6th of January 2021 as part of an effort to keep Donald Trump in office. Mark Short's testimony was confirmed by two people familiar with it, as was Greg Jacobs. The Justice Department has at times appeared to be lagging behind the House Select Committee, which has spoken to more than 1,000 witnesses, including some from inside the Trump White House. Much of the testimony has been highlighted at a series of public hearings over the past 2 months. It remains unclear precisely what Mark Short and Greg Jacob told the grand jury or what questions prosecutors may have asked them. But both previously gave recorded and transcribed interviews to the House Committee, and Mr. Jacob served as a live witness at one of the panel's public hearings that focused on the effort to strong-arm Mike Pence. Mark Short and Greg Jacob were present in the Oval Office for a meeting on 4th of January 2021 at which Donald Trump had John Eastman try to persuade Mike Pence that he could delay or block congressional certification of Mr. Trump's Electoral College defeat. John Eastman's plan relied on Mike Pence being willing to accept, as he presided over a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021, that there were disputes over the validity of electors whose votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. had already been certified by the states, a baseless assertion that had been promoted by a number of Trump allies in the previous weeks as a last-ditch way to help keep Donald Trump in office. Mike Pence ultimately rejected Donald Trump's pressure on him to go along with the plan, but the so-called fake electors proposal has been one of the primary lines of inquiry to have become public in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation. Mark Short also provided the House Committee with testimony that highlighted the sense of threat that built from Donald Trump's efforts to derail the congressional proceedings on 6th of January 2021. He told the House Committee how he had informed Mr. Pence's lead Secret Service agent on 5th of January 2021 that Donald Trump was about to publicly turn on Mike Pence over his refusal to go along with the electors' plan, potentially placing a target on his former boss's back. On 6th of January 2021, some members of the mob of Trump supporters that attacked the Capitol chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." Donald Trump reacted approvingly to the chants, effectively saying that Mike Pence deserved it, according to testimony collected by the House Committee. Mark Short's testimony to the federal grand jury was reported earlier by ABC News. Greg Jacobs' testimony was reported earlier by the Wall Street Journal. Until now, the only other pro-Trump figure, aside from rioters who were at the Capitol, known to have testified in front of a federal grand jury investigating January 6, was the prominent Stop the Steal organizer, Ali Alexander. Mr. Alexander, acting on a subpoena from prosecutors, answered questions in front of the grand jury for about 3 hours in late June. Prosecutors have also issued grand jury subpoenas to several people connected to the scheme to create false slates of electors, saying that Mr. Trump won the 2020 presidential election in swing states that were actually won by Joseph Biden Jr. Those who have received the subpoenas have largely been state lawmakers or Republican officials, many of whom put their names on documents attesting to the fact that they were electors for Donald Trump. The subpoenas, some of which have been obtained by the New York Times, show that prosecutors are interested in collecting information on a group of pro-Trump lawyers who helped to devise and carry out the plan. Among the lawyers named in the subpoenas are Rudolph Giuliani, who helped oversee Donald Trump's challenges to the election, and John Eastman, an outside lawyer who drafted several memos encouraging Donald Trump to use the fake electors as part of the campaign to pressure Mike Pence to throw him the election. Last month, federal agents stopped John Eastman outside a restaurant in New Mexico and seized his cell phone. On that same day, agents also seized electronic devices from another lawyer involved in the fake electoral scheme, Jeffrey Clark. Mr. Clark, a former Justice Department official, helped draft a letter to state officials in Georgia falsely stating that the department had evidence of election fraud in the state. If the grand jury testimony of Mark Short and Greg Jacob echoed their interviews with the House Committee, it suggests that prosecutors have likely homed in on how Donald Trump and his allies sought to pressure Mike Pence into ignoring or refusing to accept some slates of electors as he oversaw the final certification of the election. The effort to pressure Mike Pence into derailing certification of the Electoral College results was the chief focus of one of the House Committee's hearings in June. The panel provided evidence at the hearing that Donald Trump went along with the scheme despite having been told it was illegal. At the hearing, the House Committee played videotape testimony in which Greg Jacob said that John Eastman had admitted in front of Donald Trump at the January 4th meeting, 2 days before the riot, that his plan to have Mike Pence obstruct the electoral certification violated the Electoral Count Act. Greg Jacob testified to the committee that Mike Pence knew early on that the plan was unlawful. Mr. Pence's first reaction upon hearing of it, Greg Jacob said, was that there was no way this was justifiable. The pressure campaign against Mike Pence by Donald Trump and John Eastman also played a central role in a court decision this spring by a federal judge in California who said that Donald Trump and John Eastman had most likely committed federal crimes, such as obstruction of a congressional proceeding and conspiracy to defraud the United States. In the decision, which emerged from John Eastman's attempts to stop the House panel from gaining access to his emails, the judge, David Carter, noted that Donald Trump had facilitated 2 meetings in the days before the January 6th riot that were explicitly tied to persuading Vice President Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress. At the first meeting on 4th of January, Donald Trump and John Eastman invited Mike Pence, Mark Short and Greg Jacob to the Oval Office. There, Judge Carter wrote, John Eastman presented his plan to Vice President Mike Pence, focusing on either rejecting electors or delaying the count. That meeting was followed by another, Judge Carter wrote, on 5th of January 2021, during which John Eastman sought again to persuade Greg Jacob to go along with the scheme. Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history, Judge David Carter wrote.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spotlight.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistant movement warning of hitting any target in the Israeli-occupied territory. Saadat Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has sufficient defensive and offensive power at sea. Now, he made that warning as the Tel Aviv regime is embarking on extracting gas from disputed Karish field. And that's while the area is under dispute and there needs to be an agreement with Lebanon before any exploitation of the resources there. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. Political analyst Karim Shahra is joining us from the Iranian city of Qom. Also with us will be manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, in Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Beginning with Karim, as you know, there is this maritime dispute over a couple of blocks in the Mediterranean. The question is, how would it be possible for one party to want to start extracting natural resources of that region that is under dispute?
Well, that's the main problem, actually. That's the entire problem. The whole problem is that the American and Israelis are trying to pressure the Lebanese government into, first of all, accepting Israeli terms. And second of all, they're trying to delay the possible, or Lebanon's possibly benefiting from its oil and gas resources as much as possible, so as to allow the Israelis to begin extraction, while the Lebanese simply can't do anything to bring themselves out of the misfortune and the crisis they are currently living. It's actually. I have no words to describe this. I mean, this is utterly, it's not just inhumane that the Americans are putting so much pressure on Lebanon, but when finally Lebanon actually has a break and can make use of its natural resources in order to bring itself out of this crisis and bring its people a shred of hope, the Americans are just continuing to pile on more pressure and more pressure. People, I'm not sure how, look, it's like, it's exactly what the Lebanese resistance has said so far, what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has said so far. If this pressure is meant to keep the Lebanese starving, then that's not going to happen. We will not be starved. We will, I'm not quoting, of course, word for word, but the Israelis will be attacked, and we will not starve while the Israelis are allowed to make use of their natural resources. Okay. Or actually, they're stolen Palestinian natural resources.
Okay, now turning to Toronto, Firas, Israel has not sufficed to its land grab policy in occupied Palestinian land. It's been violating the Lebanese and Syrian airspace and time again to launch air raids, as you know. And now it's trying to plunder other countries' resources at sea. Your take on that?
Yes. I mean, this is only natural because the Zionist regimes
you know, establishment was based on stealing and killing and, you know, breaching international law. So it's nothing new, to be honest with you. This is the reality of the situation is that the Israeli regime will continue to violate any laws and to steal as much as they can. And this is also what Sayyid Khamenei also said about the countries that normalize with Israel, that Israel will be, you know, taking advantage of their resources and whatever is left over in their nations. And this is what Israel does from the beginning. It does this inside the land of Palestine that's occupied. We see that, you know, they have so much different areas that they've already controlled and took over. And they're building more and more settlements, and they're even going into the West Bank and trying to take places. And even inside Jerusalem, you know, Sheikh Jarrah and all these different areas, they keep taking more houses and kicking people out of their houses. And it was clear when that video came out and went out viral when that guy, the neighbor, Jacob, came outside and said that if I don't steal your house, somebody else is going to steal it. So, I mean, this is the nature of the Zionist regime and the Zionist community. Even here in Canada, they act like this, they think like this, they talk like this. When we face off with them in protests and stuff like that, we see that clearly that their mentality anywhere in the world is the same. And that's the problem is because the West gave them a green light to break all the laws and not punish them and penalize them. The United Nations sits there idly watching all these crimes committed, and there's no real punishment, there's no sanctions, there's nothing. And the Israelis now anywhere in the world think that they're above the law and that they can do anything. And this is the problem. And, you know, Hezbollah and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not be silent and will not sit idly while the Israelis try to plunder their resources, you know, at this moment.
Yeah. Okay, Karim, let's now talk a little bit about Hezbollah's drone and missile capability. You know, Hezbollah is saying it's able to hit any target in Israel using its own missiles and drones. Your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, this is something that has caused a bit of a ruckus and a lot of confusion within the Israeli military establishment and intelligence establishment. Because, first of all, Hezbollah's drone capabilities have significantly grown over the years. And so have their missile capabilities, and especially their precision missile capabilities. And so they've been trying to, they and the Americans have been trying to send, the Americans mostly, of course, the Israelis through the Americans, have been trying to send a lot of missives throughout the years to Hezbollah to get them to either back down from their missile capabilities, and try to give them some concessions in return, but they would not have this, of course, because there's no dealing with the Israelis. I mean, the only language they understand, and so anything that we have gotten so far in Lebanon has been through our use of force. Diplomacy has been utterly unsuccessful with us getting any shred of sovereignty back from the Israelis. So if we just look back at the few months that have passed so far, we can see that the Israelis are not only worried about Hezbollah's drone capabilities. In fact, during their most recent war games close to the north and on the borders with Lebanon, this reflects the state of confusion and the state of constant stress that they're living. I mean, they figured that one of their drones was one of Hezbollah's. They had no idea that this was one of their own drones. And in their state of confusion, they shot at their own drones and even failed to down that same drone, which is theirs.
Right.
The utter state of confusion in Israel and the utter state of fear that they're living because of Hezbollah's advancement in the drone and precision missile field is something that we've never seen before, not to this extent.
Okay.
And this, I believe, reflects the state of easiness or the state of ease that the how sure the resistance is of its capabilities when it's dealing with an enemy that's so afraid of growing power and its growing potential.
All right. Okay, for us, what about these differences that there are between the Lebanese side and the Israelis regarding this border demarcation and this maritime dispute? What does it take to remove those differences and come to an agreement? Is it possible?
I mean, this is up to the, you know, the United Nations if they put pressure and they really want this to be solved, right? If they give the Zionist regime, you know, the open space to and delay the process and play games so Israel can actually plunder the resources and steal the resources, then we're not going to come down to a resolution. And this is the main point. And as it seems, even the person that they used, and appointed to be the mediator between the Lebanese government and the Zionist regime is a Zionist himself. So he's really looking out for the Zionist interests, and he's probably working on the strategy of what the Zionists want. He's not looking for the interest of both parties, or for world peace, or for the United Nations Charter of Rights and stuff like this. It seems like the person is himself, as I was reading, I remember reading that he also was part of the IDF at a certain point. So this is obviously not the right person to be appointed in this process. Mm-hmm. As it seems, it's Israel are already they've already have their ships over there. I think they're cooperating and collaborating with some kind of Greek company that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has warned them to pull out. So they're already, I think, in the process of, they've already breached the law. They've already, they didn't care about this negotiation, because if they did, everything would be pulled back. And once the negotiation has been complete and they've got down to an agreement, then the next process happens, whether Lebanese go to extract it or the Zionists get to go to extract it or so on. But right. As it seems, like I said, there's no real resolution and there's nothing that they're really working on to resolve this. So I think the resistance, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says that the only way forward is to, confiscate our rights. And that is by resisting and fighting. And he's giving an opportunity, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, I think, is giving a big opportunity to the Lebanese government and to the United mm-hmm. Nations and to all the parties to get to resolve this issue before it escalates to a military confrontation. And I know that it's pretty sure that Hezbollah is ready for that. As Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in his recent interview that he had with Al-Mayadeen, and also it was also the anniversary of the 40th year of the foundation and establishment of Hezbollah. So I think that he's ready for a big confrontation with the Zionist regime, and they know that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Karim, I want to put the same question to you. Do you believe that there is a way out of this, and this maritime dispute could be resolved? And even if it's resolved, how would you guarantee that Tel Aviv will stick to it?
Like your guest said, if the person who's actually mediating for who's mediating is Amos Hochstein. He's a famed Zionist, and he's siding with the Israelis at all times. He's constantly piling pressure on the Lebanese Lebanese officials so that they would concede even more territory to the Israelis. Of course, the Lebanese officials were not about to let this happen. And Hezbollah was not about to let Lebanon's sovereignty be desecrated to such an extent. Mm-hmm. So the recent statements made by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah before yesterday's interview, these statements actually had the Israelis begging Hochstein to come to Lebanon and try to reach a settlement with the Lebanese side. Like I said earlier, there's no way to discuss anything with the Israelis through diplomacy. Force and deterrence is the only thing that would have us secure our rights. So when these statements were made, the Hochstein was flying to Lebanon again in order to try to broker a deal with the Lebanese more that would fit more with our own interests. But of course, they were not going to concede all the way. And I think a large amount of the statements made by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah yesterday during the interview was meant to deliver a message to the Israelis that, because look, there's a lot of information and confusion in the Israeli military and in intelligence establishment regarding what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said. Some of them are saying that there's a lot to be worried about, and Hezbollah would definitely live up to its promises. And others are saying, well, yes, Hezbollah may have the capability, but it won't risk igniting a war on the front with, or opening a new front with Israel.
Uh-huh.
But even those saying that Hezbollah will not open a new front with Israel are saying that we need to be very careful because it does have the capabilities to start a new war, mm-hmm. even though it may not want to. So this confusion is driving Hochstein to come to Lebanon again in order to try to broker a deal with the Lebanese side. So
okay.
How will it be resolved? Hopefully, it'll be resolved as per the Lebanese government's requests, meaning that they will abide by the line set by the Lebanese government. And pressure will be taken off foreign companies trying to explore for gas and oil in our fields, because we've had such rounds before. The energy giant Total has been in Lebanon before, and they went to, I believe, Block 9 near the south of Lebanon. It's one of the largest of the blocks. And and even though we were sure that there was oil and gas there, they were really late giving us the report back. And even when they did give it back, they said there was nothing there. So it was clear that there was a lot of political pressure being piled on Total so that they would give back such a faulty report to the Lebanese officials.
Okay.
So what we're hoping for is that this pressure would be taken off foreign companies so that we would begin exploring for gas and oil.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Firas, given all the points that we've raised so far in this show and discussed, and given the current circumstances, what's the possibility of a war?
I think it's very possible because the Zionists are very arrogant, and the United Nations never doing its job where it's supposed to broker peace deals and come down to resolutions and respect international law. Certain countries have they have like immunity; they don't have to really follow the laws. So I think, infully, the Zionist regime will be taught a lesson by a certain military advancement by Hezbollah. Coordinated hopefully with the Lebanese government, and at that point maybe they will not want to proceed into going into a major war, and knowing they know Hezbollah, they've tested them in 2006 and before that, and in the war that was before that when they liberated Lebanon, and they know that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a very credible man. He's got a very strong support base inside Lebanon, and at the same time even the Zionist regime call him the Al-Adu al-Sadiq in Arabic. It means the honest enemy. Mm-hmm. They know he's honest. They know he doesn't lie, he doesn't deceive, he doesn't manipulate like them, and that if he says something, he does it. So at the end of the day, they should be prepared for a war, and hopefully we can avoid major wars, and we can claim sovereignty over the resources of the Lebanese country.
Karim, we had this Mr. Frederick Hoff. He was a U.S. diplomat in charge of mediation between Israel and Lebanon between the years 2010 and 2012. And he proposed Lebanon to have 55% and to Israel to have 45% of the disputed area, which Beirut at that time did not accept. Was that a fair solution?
Of course that wasn't a fair solution, because if Lebanon was going to have 55%, well, the Israelis already have... look, the thing is, we're going back to square one with this, because if supposedly this would work, first of all, the American side could always pile pressure on the on foreign oil and gas companies in order to have them constantly delay any work that they're doing, and so allowing the Israelis, who have already begun extraction, to use these 45% in order to extract whatever they can from the Lebanese side. I mean, they're already stealing our water. They're already stealing any natural resources that we have. So if we share this block, that means effectively that the Israelis will be able to use their already established facilities in order to drain whatever we have from our side. This, of course, isn't going to work. This was just a maneuver in order to get the Lebanese side to feel like they've been able to accomplish something, to claim some sort of victory. It was aimed to allow those in Lebanon who have certain doubts or who are not strong of heart to accept such a political resolution. But this wasn't going to, I mean, this wasn't going to come to pass. The Israelis, like I said, they would have drained us of anything we would have shared with them in that block, and they would have rendered that block, for all intents and purposes, ineffective for the Lebanese side. We wouldn't be able to explore anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, for us, given the plethora of economic woes and issues that Lebanon is already grappling with, how significant is the resolution of this maritime dispute?
Yeah, this Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said at this point, this is one of the most important economical resolutions and solutions for our nation right now, because the embargo is heavy, you know, and all these different countries that are collaborating with the U.S. and Israel are doing their own sanctions against Lebanon in different ways, and they're putting pressures on different politicians, different companies, you know, and they're even you know, telling their own citizens not to travel to Lebanon and so on. Making false claims as if it's a dangerous zone or so on. So it's a very difficult time right now economically for the Lebanese people. And it's a big test and trial, you know, for the Lebanese people and especially for the Lebanese politicians. And I think the only way forward right now is this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity of resources that can be used to bring in a good amount of, you know, funds and money and so on to help the people of Lebanon, and hopefully it will be shared equally to all the Lebanese people inside Lebanon. You know, it won't go to like one side. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that if Hezbollah was able to, you know, secure these resources and the gas in the maritime, I think that it will be you know, shared equally inside Lebanon, because Hezbollah cares, the people of Lebanon does not care only about, you know, their people or their supporters or the Shias or so on. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has proven this, that he cares about all of Lebanon, and he's a patriotic person as well. He's a very principled man, cares about the whole region, cares about the security of the region, the sovereignty of the region, and the liberation of Palestine. And we see that consistently with his sacrifices. You know, he sacrificed his son fighting against the Zionist regime and fighting for his land and fighting for the Palestinian cause. Where do you find a leader these days that has sacrificed his son fighting the battle? You know, this is very rare. So we have to take all this into consideration.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had political analyst Karim Sharara in Qom, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm in Toronto, with her comments and insight. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. This is the end of this edition of the Spotlight.